It's the Fryer Cocktail with Anna Glavinsky.
So as I was talking about at the start of the show, there are many different ways to celebrate love, or different types of love that can be celebrated on Valentine's Day. But the main one, the most obvious one, is the one between couples, relationships. And I'm really delighted to be joined on the line today by Dr. Warren Farrell. He's an author, and he's also done loads of work with couples to work out what keeps couples together, what makes a happy relationship. And he's offering us 7 secrets to lifelong love. So if that's not a great Valentine's gift, then I don't know what is. Hi, Warren. Nice to see you here.
I'm looking forward to talking with you. And actually, I'm coming to London later today.
Are you? That's great. Where are you coming in from?
I'm coming in from San Francisco.
Ah, have you been to London before?
Many times, yes.
Yeah. And would you say that in different parts of the world, there are different types of successful romantic relationships? And, you know, if you compare, I don't know, London with San Francisco, places that you know very well, do people react to relationships and love differently?
Basically, every person in a relationship, straight, gay, in London or Africa, has the same basic problem. Well, once survival is taken care of, the problem is the inability to handle personal criticism without becoming defensive. And the more you love somebody, the more vulnerable you feel. So the vulnerability leads to you not having, you know, being able to handle criticism, even if the love is very deep, except at the very beginning of the relationship where, you know, you really want to please somebody and, you know, you're so addicted to that love drug that you're able to hear a little criticism and, you know, okay, it's all right, I'll change that, you know, type of thing. And you do something that, like, ski, if you've never skied before, and you bend over backwards and you're adaptive. But, you know, once the relationship gets underway and that love drug has worn off a little bit, the inability to handle personal criticism without becoming defensive, that was, I've done this role mate to soulmate workshop for 30 years. And when I was at the beginning of the workshop, I would advise this and everybody would agree, yes, important wisdom. Then they'd go home and I would schedule follow-up phone calls for everybody in the workshop. And 3-6 months later, they said, you know, when that wisdom of, you know, when the criticism appeared, the wisdom disappeared. So I started to wonder if I could develop a way of being able to get people in relationships to associate personal criticism from their loved one with an opportunity to actually feel loved rather than the feeling of being destroyed, you know, or criticized or put down by their loved one.
Yeah, that is such a good point. And I'm nodding along here because I'm going to completely embarrass myself live on the radio, but I'm just nodding along because I'm married. I'd say we've got a fairly decent relationship, pretty happily married. However, there was a moment, you know, just today even, where I got really annoyed at him for exactly what you're saying, what I took as a personal criticism. And then I got really defensive. And so, you know, I'd ask him to do something when he was leaving the house. I'd ask him to get a book out of my car because he was dropping our kiddo off at school and he needed that book. And then I found out that he hadn't taken the book out of my car. And then he said, well, you could have got it out of the car. And I just was so irritated. They actually hung up on him. It just hung up. And then like 2 seconds later, I was like, that was incredibly childish. And called him back and pretended that my phone had cut out. because I realized I was being a complete idiot. And I was like, oh, no, that's not a very healthy way of dealing with it. I'll just say my phone cut out and then carry on with the conversation as normal.
Well, that's a perfect example and just so sweet. And it's so nice of you to be able to share that on Valentine's Day. So that was like the double level of defensiveness, the one, the doing that, and then the other one, pretending your phone cut out. So what I eventually was able to develop for the workshop participants was a way of setting aside 2 hours a week that I call a caring and sharing time. And during that 2 hours a week, only one concern is shared by your partner to you. But before you share that concern is shared, you do an appreciation, two appreciations at 3 or 4 levels of specificity. And then you end it that way. But in between is the key to the whole, you know, role mate to soulmate book and course. Mm-hmm. And that is that before you hear the criticism, you alter your biologically natural state. That is, biologically speaking, when you heard criticism, it was a potential enemy. So therefore, it was functional for survival to kill the enemy before the enemy killed you, which would be like what you did with your husband. Right? So what I worked on is getting the couple to go into six different mindsets, and with those six mindsets, associate the criticism with an opportunity to be more deeply loved. So I'll give an example. Mindset one is called the love guarantee, and you say to your partner, if I provide a safe and secure environment for you to say whatever you want to say, whatever you, in whatever tone of voice you say it, even if I completely disagree with what you're saying, but if I nevertheless don't force you to be walking on eggshells around me, you'll feel more loved by me, and therefore you'll feel more love for me. And so he or she, the one about ready to hear the criticism, just settles into that association of criticism with an opportunity to be more deeply loved. And in the workshops, I have couples sit back to back and fill out a piece of paper that their partner will never see. That I tell them their partner will never see. And I ask this question. I say to them, imagine your partner is about to be killed, like drown or in a car accident. And you know with 100% certainty that you could save their life. But you have a 50% chance of losing your own life in the process. Imagine that was happening and children were not part of the equation. And so would you do it? Yes, no, uncertain. About 90% of the men and about 80% of the women say yes, they would risk their own life at a 50% level to save their partner's life. So the second meditation is, if I'm willing to die for you, maybe I can listen to you. It sort of puts it in perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. How did you come up with that concept? Was that from, because obviously you've done extensive research on this. You spent many, many years in sort of gender role and gender psychology. That's mm-hmm. what you studied. So how have you sort of come up with these strategies over time?
I sort of think inside of myself, what could work here? And I hear people say, my goodness, I'd do anything for my partner. And then, including die. And especially guys will say that. And so I say, well, I would say things like, what about listening? And so, that was some of the beginnings of just, well, maybe I'll institutionalize this, that I'll make this into part of the practice. But I still found that when I did this in the workshop, people went home and then they oftentimes, just didn't follow through. And so I created an online video course, that is an 11-hour course that a couple can actually practice all these experiences together. And I persuaded my publisher to let me, put the online, a QR code to the online video course, in the book and make it available for practically free. And so that's what really changes people. People need to really practice this again and again, because it is biologically unnatural to do that.
Biologically unnatural. What do you mean by that?
By what I was saying before about, when you heard criticism historically and biologically, it was a potential enemy. And so it was functional for you to get up your defenses or even kill the enemy before the enemy killed you. And so defensiveness was functional for survival. It's just dysfunctional for love.
Right. And am I right in thinking that you've been doing these courses for 30 years and your book is a culmination of what you've seen and experienced in those courses?
100% right. Okay. Yes. And also, it's not just that. I asked everybody in my course, I gave them free follow-up phone calls to tell me 6 months and a year later, everything that worked well and everything that worked poorly. And so I kept refining the meditations, for example, the mindsets. I kept refining it and refining it until I got six mindsets that really worked for people.
Could you briefly give us an overview of those mindsets? Obviously, yes. Getting the book, then people will be able to dive into that far more deeply, but just an idea so we can understand it.
Sure. The first one is that love guarantee. The second one is that experience that they do with each other about the dying. Another one is the word hold. So I ask people to say hold if they're losing, if they're beginning to do something that I call self-listening. So the biologically natural thing to do when your partner is criticizing you, especially if she or he is going on for a while, is that you start thinking in your own mind's eye what you can say to explain why you did this or, you know, to defend yourself.
Right.
And so you're not really listening to your partner, you're self-listening. And so, and because that's biologically natural, I say, just when you find yourself self-listening, just say the word hold. And hold means not shut up. It means the opposite of shut up. That what you, it means what you're, you say is so important to me. I'm not going to be self-listening while you're talking. I'm going to center myself. I'm going to go back to the mindsets, find which mindset really centers me. Like, if I could die for you, at least I can do is listen to you. Oh boy, I'm not listening to you now. I'm going to go back and listen to you. Okay, I got that. And then you go back and say, okay, now I'm ready to really hear you.
Lovely. Yeah. And the next one?
Let's see. The next one is embarrassing myself here. It's called stream. And so when your partner is really angry, I ask the person says to themselves, I will visualize that as pollution in a stream. And when I provide, when I listen to you, that will be like a filter that will filter out your pollution, that will filter out your anger. Because once you feel heard, that pollution will go away. And I will see the beautiful you, again, just like I see the beautiful stream after it goes through that filter.
Lovely. That's really sweet. What a nice vision. And anything else on those mindsets?
Yeah, I ask people to do eye contact, but eye contact only, oftentimes psychologists will say, look at your partner as if, you know, like you're really supportive of them. And I say, don't do that until you really have prepared yourself to be supportive. Because if you're seducing through supportive eye contact, your partner to say something that you are not going to listen to well and only become defensive, then you're seducing them to be vulnerable. So make sure you have really prepared yourself to be able to really hear your partner before you give them supportive eye contact.
Right. And why is eye contact so important? You know, you started off with this situation where you've got your partner sitting back to back, and then there's this mm-hmm. build up to actually giving conscious eye contact. I guess those mm-hmm. things are done for a reason. What have you noticed about that sort of body language and interaction between couples?
When a person feels a person's love in the eyes of someone listening and that they're really ready to associate this with love, then they really, they're more likely to open up and trust. And you remember through your partner's eyes, what you love about your partner, when that is supportive.
Yeah. And the next mindsets, I believe we're on five or six now.
Yes. One is a cinema. And cinema is that you imagine yourself in a movie theater. And in that movie theater, you remember that when somebody is telling a story that you disagree with, you don't stand up and argue with the story. You listen to the story. You immerse yourself in it. If you feel some tension inside of you, you say to yourself, it's only a movie. And when your partner is speaking, she or he isn't hitting you. So you can treat it as a movie. Let me hear their story. I don't interrupt. I don't, in the theater, I immerse myself in the story. So that is called cinematic immersion. That one.
Like that one. And I believe there's one more.
That's the mindset.
That's the final one.
That's the six mindsets. Okay. But once that works, that's 2 hours a week. The important thing is that the other 166 hours a week, London and the U.S. have the same number of hours a week. And the other 166 hours a week, I teach people how to create a conflict-free zone. So when your partner says something like, you know, you left the dishes in the sink today, and your temptation is to say, well, you left the dishes in the sink the other day, and yeah, I didn't say anything to you, so why are you picking on me? So once you've had this experience of having your partner really be able to hear you when you have a response, once your partner does a criticism, you can either say to yourself, you can visualize either I can respond right now, and the chances are it will escalate and I'll be hurt. Or alternatively, I can respond during the caring and sharing time, and with about 100% certainty, I'll be heard. So which do I want? But if you choose being heard, what do you do about the anger you have inside of yourself that, you know, that you really want to respond? So then I ask people to go through a number of to journal. And in their journal, the first thing that they do is write down this is what I call the self-righteous stage. You write down every reason you're right and every reason your partner is wrong. Get that out of your system. And then step two, well, one or two things I can see from my partner's perspective. And step three is a number of things. And step four, you write the whole process from your partner's perspective, as if you were arguing your partner's argument. And another one I'll give you is to maintain the conflict-free zone is to do something that everyone is shocked that I suggest in the workshop, because I'm this Mr. Integrity. And so this next one seems to fly in the face of that. I say, fake it till you make it. And so what I mean by that, let's say you've had an argument with your husband now, and you come home and you make his favorite dessert. Or he's sitting in front of the computer and you just come up and kiss him on the neck, rub him on the shoulders. Or you go out and buy him flowers. And while you're buying him flowers, you think, you know, gee, you anticipate that he's going to respond like really in a loving way. Like, that was so nice of you. And yeah, you know, we had a little tension before, and I see you're reaching out to me and expressing some love through the purchase of these flowers. And so the anticipation of him responding differently when you buy those flowers and give them to him, softens your feelings toward him because you anticipate that response.
Absolutely. And I'm nodding along here. These are really nice techniques. And like you say, if people get the book, it's going to be explained in more detail. So without giving everything away, I'd really like to ask you, because obviously you've built this up over years of working out what works for people, and you've developed these very positive strategies. Is there anything that, you know, in that trial and error process that didn't work, you know, or things that surprised you? You know, looking back, you thought, you know, it's going to go in this direction, this is what people need, and then you've ended up throwing it out the window because you've discovered that that's not how it goes at all in relationships.
Yeah, I had a number of mindsets. One was the detective and mindset, and without getting into it too much, it just didn't work that well for couples. But for some people, it worked very well. So it was one of those things that wasn't dependable, but I put it in there as an extra that you could experiment with. And so that was one example of that.
Okay. And what about any lovely stories of couples that have maybe gone through your workshops over the years that particularly stand out to you? You know, stories that we can share on Valentine's Day.
Yeah, I have had a number of couples come up to me after the workshop and say, I want to tell you, Dr. Farrell, you know, we actually, before we did this Roommate to Soulmate, we'd already filed for a divorce. And on Monday, it's a 3-day workshop on Monday, we're going to our lawyers tomorrow, and we have decided to ask for that filing to be stopped. And then I hear from them a year or so later, and they're still together, and they have had their first child. And wow, it's things like that that keep me doing this.
I guess that makes it really rewarding what you do as well. Okay. You know, it's not just a job, it's a purpose.
It really is. But the problem was, I found that when people read the book, they got a sort of foundational wisdom. But they didn't necessarily hold on to it. So I persuaded my publisher to allow me to put into the Roommate to Soulmate book a QR code in which people could very inexpensively access an 11-hour course in which a couple could not just read it, but practice it, because I found that it really, you know, in order to change our natural brain from being defensive to being receptive, people had to really go ahead and practice the course over and over again, and not just read about it once, because your brain, you really have to change your brain to have different neurons connect, so that when you hear criticism, you can visualize quickly, well, wait a minute, I can respond to that at the caring and sharing time, not get into an argument now.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense. Actually, there's a lot of situations like that where it's about practice and habit forming before those normal neural pathways are formed. So that makes absolute sense. I'd like to ask you a couple of questions just about your background and opinions on things, because this obviously is not your first book. You've done a lot of research into gender issues. First of all, is this book designed for straight couples?
It's designed for straight and gay couples. One of the fascinating things in the workshop is seeing that, you know, the couples that are gay say, you know, this is just so relevant to me, because everyone who loves someone feels defensive. And even people you meet on a plane who disagree with you, you're never going to see them again. You're usually a little bit more open to hearing their perspectives, but oftentimes if they criticize you directly, like, you know, you just spoke too loud, or you're sitting too close to me, or whatever, you can respond defensively even in those circumstances. And part of the book is called From Civil War to Civil Dialogue. And it's about getting together with family members at, say, Christmas or the holidays or something. And during oftentimes, you know, somebody in the United States, somebody will support Trump, and somebody will, you know, be a strong Democrat. And so, and those two people sort of feel like oftentimes they don't value each other. They feel like there's something wrong with the other person's values. So I teach people in the book how to hear somebody that you love that is not your partner, that has very different political views, and how to go about doing that so that person feels heard, without any requirement that they hear you. Now, usually once they feel heard, they're so gratified that you see the best, you see the virtue in the vice. So normally speaking, let's say one person's a feminist and some person's an anti-feminist. And so the feminist job is to say to the anti-feminist, the anti-feminist job is to say to the feminist, okay, even though DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion has gone too far and it's become cancel culture, nevertheless, I see that my wife and my daughter are going to have opportunities that they never would have had if it wasn't for the feminist movement. So you're finding the virtue behind the vice of cancel culture that you are focused on normally, the cancel culture vice, as opposed to the virtue of what feminism has introduced.
Yeah, absolutely. So these are just really great life skills that you can apply in any situation with anybody, not just couple skills and couple management.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And even when you do this and then take it and say, okay, even a colleague at work, you don't have to love somebody, but you know, the more a colleague is filled with anger or angst about some political point of view, usually those are the people who need to be heard first, not argued with first. And you don't have to change your perspective at all. But when they feel their story is heard, they don't have so much insecurity that they have to keep pouring it out and saying it again and again.
Yeah, totally. And I'm just looking at the clock here because we are getting quite short on time, but it's such an opportunity to have you here in the line. And I'd like to pick your brains about some other opinions and other things that you've researched in time, because it's just topical. It's topical to this show and it's topical to today's world, because you've done a lot of research on different gender issues. So you've studied feminism. You've also put books out, The Myth of Male Power and The Boy Crisis. And as someone who's bringing up a little boy, you know, I'm interested in that,
yes,
that area, I suppose. And I'd just like to hear your opinion about, you know, why those books came out and what you have to say about that angle.
Yes. In fact, I'll be speaking on The Boy Crisis book in London in a few days.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes. So, yes. The boy, so if you were to take the boy crisis, down to one sentence, I'd say the boy crisis resides where dads do not reside. Now, there are many reasons for the boy crisis, but that's the most important one. And so what is when you see boys who are addicted to guns, addicted to video games, have died from overdose, are mass shooters, boys that have problems on, that have dropped out of high school, that have dropped out of college, that have never gone to college, that are living in their parents' basement. The greatest single likely predictor of that is dad deprivation, minimally involved dad. So if you're a person listening to this now and you have a in your divorce, let's say, worst case scenario, it's so important to make sure that there are at least four things that happen. One is that the father and mother are equally involved with the child's life. Number two, that the mother and father do not live more than 20 minutes drive time from each other. Number three, that the children cannot detect any bad mouthing about the father or the mother from the other parent. And number four, that there's consistent couples counseling. Emergency-based couples counseling is usually very time short. And so you focus on what's wrong with your partner. The important thing to do in a marriage that has a divorce is to know how to see your partner's best intent. A father will, for example, often prevent a child from, to say to a child, don't, you have to do your homework before you go to bed. So fathers actually set bedtimes that are later than moms set bedtimes. But children under dad's supervision get to bed earlier because there's a greater likelihood that the child will be able to manipulate the mother into saying, oh, mom, I didn't finish my homework. And, you know, I've got to do that. And mom will feel, oh my God, I don't want you to go to school without your homework being done. So of course, you should have done that while you were talking to your friend on the phone, but I can't let you go to school without your homework being done. And dad will often say, like, I gave you a warning once before. You didn't do your homework. When you had the chance to, you insisted on playing that video game. So I'm sorry, but you're going to go to school without doing your homework. And now if they're separated, the mom goes, what? He let you go to school without doing your homework? But what dad is trying to do is to create postponed gratification. That is, take responsibility for your bad decisions and pay the consequences of them. There's no perfect answer to how to do that, but the mom and dad need to know each other's best intent.
Hmm. God, there's so much that I could pick your brains on, but we really have run out of time. So really fantastic news about the launch of your book, Role Mate to Soulmate. And also best of luck at the talk in London on the boy crisis. I wish I could be there.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure talking with you. You're so able to ask questions. You have such warmth in your eyes and you listen so well. So it's a real pleasure.
Oh, thanks so much. It's very kind of you. And it truly has been a pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you.
Have a lovely day. That was Dr. Warren Farrell, and his book is called Roulmate to Soulmate, The 7 Secrets to Lifelong Love. Perfect for Valentine's Day. If you want to get your hands on it, you can find it on the Talk Radio Europe bookshop, or you can pop it into Google.